Welcome to the Marvelous Synergy Podcast, a podcast all about the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I am your host, Andy Tai, writer of several guides to the MCU, which are also called Marvelous Synergy. This episode will focus on the seventh film of the franchise, also the first film of Phase 2, Iron Man 3. Joining me today is a huge Iron Man fan, Emmanuel Manalad.
Hey Andy, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm doing very well. So Emmanuel, what makes Iron Man your favorite character?
Yeah, so I think it starts off from being a kid in the 90s watching TV shows, and I think probably the most memorable ones are actually Spider-Man and Iron Man, but because I am such a huge fan of, you know, Gundam and mechs, I think I tended to gravitate a little bit more towards Iron Man than any other superhero in the Marvel Universe.
All right, sounds good. Okay, let's get started. So, Iron Man 3 was released on the 3rd of May in 2013. It was directed by Shane Black, who previously directed a film called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which also had Robert Downey Jr. in it. The film made over $1.2 billion worldwide and was the second highest grossing film of 2013, behind Frozen, of course. So, let's get your general thoughts, Emmanuel, because Iron Man 3 is a bit of a polarizing film amongst fans. What did you think of it?
And I think at the end of the day, when I think of Iron Man 3, overall, I enjoyed it. I think it probably helped that I was actually a worker at the cinemas at the time of Iron Man 3's release. So I'd actually been able to watch it quite a few times. I made sure to actually watch it earlier because, you know, working in the cinema, you'd encounter a lot of people who tend to talk about it as they walk out. So, you know, me being an Iron Man fan, I didn't really want the spoilers to kind of get to me. So it also helps me relate to, you know, moviegoers as they come in. You know, can I say that Iron Man 3 is a good movie? Yeah, I definitely have to agree when, you know, it is a controversial release, and I think we'll get to that later. You know, it felt like they had really wanted to wrap up RDJ's Iron Man with this film, which kind of didn't make sense to me because obviously we knew that the Avengers kind of wasn't finished yet. You know, it felt like there was more, but then why are they wrapping it up here in Iron Man 3? And I think that kind of approach to the film adds to the incomplete kind of feeling that you have at the end of this movie. But I think overall, there is a lot of moments to kind of enjoy. You get to, you know, experience Iron Man more from Tony's perspective. He does a lot of self-growth in this film. You know, it's quite good, you know, how you see the effects of the events in Avengers kind of affect his life afterwards and the people around him. And then as the story goes, you know, he's really got only his you know, his wit and his will to kind of get by, you know, basically after the start of the film where, you know, he loses basically everything that he's got. So I think definitely a great journey for Tony Stark, a bleak kind of future for Iron Man. You wanted to see more. And then, you know, I think it sort of almost drops the ball at the end, but you kind of just hope for the best. And, you know, before we knew the events of Age of Ultron, you know, you're kind of not sure where Iron Man kind of fits in, and, you know, the fact that he started the whole MCU, you hope that he still has one of the more critical roles, which is great that they were, you know, they were able to kind of pay that off in Endgame.
Yeah, for myself, I quite like Iron Man 3 because it's very different from the first two films. As you said, it focuses largely on Tony as Tony and not Iron Man. And another thing, I guess, is also because the character's quite established at this point in the MCU, you know, they can play around with it a bit. So one of the things I absolutely love is the fact that the film opens not with an AC/DC song, but with Blue by I-465. That made me laugh so much when that music started playing in the cinema.
Yeah, you know, I definitely have to agree with that. It actually is one of my most favorite MCU intros out of all the films that we've got now, because you know, it's just a really enjoyable song to have, and it always, funnily enough, just makes my playlist every time I watch Iron Man 3. So yeah, it's definitely one of my favorite intros.
So let's talk about Tony a bit more. I think it was a very smart move for them to focus on Tony and seeing how he's very smart. You know, he's using his intellect a lot in this film. You see, it's in the fact that he has to learn to operate without the suit and to use his sort of wits and ingenuity a bit more. And there's huge chunks of this film without Iron Man. And I wonder if that's part of the reason why it got such a mixed reception, I guess, because people maybe they were expecting more Iron Man as opposed to Tony Stark.
Yeah, I think that would definitely be a case. But I don't mind that it does focus a lot more on Tony Stark as a character.
I think you kind of need that, right? Especially after the Avengers and the past two Iron Man films, where we get a lot of the snarky Tony or the sort of the coolness of Iron Man. And this, and as you said, yeah, this film strips him down. Brings him back to his roots, the basic character. And it just allows Robert Downey Jr. to just put in such a great performance.
Yeah, his performance, is as great as ever. In terms of Tony Stark as well, I think it really pays off some of the things that he has, in future. I know we're talking about Iron Man 3, and it's a while before Spider-Man Homecoming. It definitely pays off his line where, he says to Peter, and he's like, if you're nothing without the suit, you don't deserve it.
That's a good point there.
I think one of the things that I really enjoy about Iron Man in the MCU is he's a character that learns from each movie that goes by. So, you can even see it in his suits. A lot of the suits, you see their progression from something that he learns from, something that a previous suit can't do. Like in Iron Man 1, where the Mark II freezes, starts to freeze at a certain altitude, the Mark III doesn't. Things like that, where, he's constantly learning. And I think this learning curve for Tony is crucial for, the person that he's got to be come, Age of Ultron, Civil War, and, Infinity War, and essentially Endgame.
Oh, it's interesting that you brought up the suits, because in this film, I mean, you see Tony make up so many different armors in between his time, after the Avengers. And I love how some of them are very niche in their function. Like, he's got, one that can go into space, one that can go underwater. As a fan, from the comics and seeing how many armors he has in the source material, the fact that they gave him a whole legion of them in this film was definitely a highlight for me. Which one's your favorite suit?
So in terms of my favorite suit, I would have to go from a suit that's actually, funnily enough, not in Iron Man 3. So I'm going to say the Mark 45, which is featured at the start of Age of Ultron, which is essentially the Mark 42, with a little bit more red on it, because if you know me, I like a lot of red. But that said, if I bring it back to Iron Man 3, I'm going to actually say the 42. The Mark 42 has its own kind of character. It really separates Iron Man and Tony Stark, but neither can kind of work without the other. And it's just a very fun and creative way to have Iron Man in the movie, but not at the same time. And I think some of the events that happened in the movie were some of the most hilarious things. I don't know if you remember the part where, he's rescuing people falling from the...
Oh, the Barrel of Monkeys sequence.
The Barrel of Monkeys sequence when they're falling from the plane. I think that's definitely one of my favorite sequences. Because even at this point, like superhero movies, you don't see much saving people. And I think, it was a great way to kind of save people. And then that payoff where he kind of flies off and gets hit by the truck, and then you just find out that he's controlling the suit remotely. I think that's both technologically cool and absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, for me, I quite like... Well, there are two suits that I really liked. Interesting enough, both don't get that much screen time, but I love the design of the Mark 22, the Hot Rod, because it's got the flames on the legs. I just thought that's such a cool little design feature. And I do like the color scheme of the Mark 27, the disco suit, because it's blue and orange. Love those two colors. The suit has like camouflage capabilities or whatnot, and I don't think we really got to see that in the film, but I just love it because of the color scheme.
You know, it's actually funny that you mentioned that, because one of the things that I really liked about the cartoon Iron Man was the Hall of Armor. And every episode, you get to see Tony go down the hall. And, like, I don't know if many of you know, it's like this underground cylindrical place, and all his armors are just, like, all surrounding him. And, you know, he kind of just changes into Iron Man there. And I think I really wanted to see that in this film. I would have liked to see in a little bit more detail or better light the other armors. You know, it was good to see some, you know, noteworthy armors, like, you know, the Silver Centurion and the Heartbreaker armor as well. You know, and Igor as well, whom, you know, I thought in the trailer was definitely a Hulkbuster fake out. I wasn't sure if that was actually going to be the Hulkbuster, but, you know, in the end, it wasn't. And all it was, you know, all it was there to do was prevent part of the structure in the final battle from falling. No, it would have definitely been great to, you know, explore a little bit more of the armors. And I think it's definitely one of my disappointments to see Tony having blown up all of them. I think he should have probably ended up at least recreating them and just, you know, having them there and be actually part of the Iron Legion later in Age of Ultron, as opposed to the generic suits that we end up seeing there.
You know, another thing I quite like with this film is that they put Tony in different situations, and yet he's still very much, you know, the Tony Stark we know and love, even though he's, you know, he's afflicted with PTSD and or whatnot. And I love that you see him interact with a kid, so Harley Keener in this case. And he doesn't treat him like a kid. You know, he's very harsh the way he speaks to him. And yeah, I just found it very interesting very refreshing in a sense. What did you think of Harley? Was he a character that stood out for you?
Oh, definitely. I think this, you know, Harley is actually a really key character for Tony in terms of learning how to deal with his, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder and reminding him that he actually is, you know, at the basics, a builder. So I definitely like Harley's character. He is definitely quite a hilarious addition to the cast of Iron Man. So no, his character is quite crucial for Tony, and I like the sort of interactions where they, you know, the banter that they have is actually quite hilarious and brutal.
Yeah, the banter's good.
You know, the fact that, you know, Harley, he'll kind of return the joke kind of thing. But I think one of my favorite interactions with Harley and Tony is Tony's asking Harley about the status of the charging of the Mark 42 suit, and it's not going well. So Tony starts to break down, and I think one of the key moments in the film is where Harley's like, Tony, like, you're a builder, you know, you can build things, and in time, like, the armor is going to be charged. And then Tony actually, and you notice that no other character that has been there during one of Tony's episodes has been able to calm him down and get him to move. You know, Rhodey, at the start of the film, kind of just gets left behind by Tony. Pepper is like, I'm going to sleep downstairs, because the Mark 42 armor kind of just grabbed her while she's trying to calm him down. But in this case, Harley is able to remind Tony of what he can do. And I think that's very important for many people these days as well, where some of us experience PTSD, or we have episodes where, you know, we have panic attacks. And sometimes there is that one person that just kind of just reminds you of who you are, kind of thing. And I think that's a very relatable part of Tony, and I really like that scene. And then it just kind of just fast forwards to Tony at what Australians would call a Bunnings, and he's he's just buying all this stuff, and then you just get like Assassin's Creed Tony Stark with, you know, his makeshift Iron Man gear. And I think it's quite interesting to see him kind of downplay all the high-tech gadgetry that the Iron Man suit has. And I think it really just pays off how ingenuitive Tony Stark really is, and that, you know, he really is Iron Man, whether he's got the suit or not. And I think that's definitely one of the key messages about this movie, and something that Harley really brings to the table. So I think now that you've mentioned Harley, I think it's, you know, great that you actually see him in one of the scenes in Endgame. And, you know, albeit because of puberty.
You didn't recognize him, did you?
barely anyone kind of just recognized him. I think it took, like, after the film, be like, who is this person standing here in this scene? And we just realized that it's Harley. I think it's really great to bring him back to that, because Tony was, you know, he was there for Tony as much as Tony was there for him. You know what, now that I mention it, I think it would have been great to see more of what Tony did for Harley. So I definitely think that was another missed opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, you could very much tell that Tony saw in Harley a sort of a younger version of himself, right? I mean, Harley is an inventor, a creator, and Tony recognizes that he gets bullied as well. And you could sort of see that Tony sort of sees his past in Harley and understands why Harley does some of the things he does. And yeah, no, I think you're right. It's a huge, huge shame that we don't see his character develop. And I have a feeling it's because Peter Parker came and kind of took over that role, right?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So Tony
Stark mentor Peter instead later.
I think it kind of would have been, it would have been difficult to have, you know, Peter instead of Harley before he became Spider-Man. I think Harley is just one of those perfect roles for the movie. But yeah, it's just a shame that because they tried to wrap up the story with Iron Man 3, that his character kind of just ended up going nowhere.
I think the problem was, I'm trying to recall exactly, but I believe Robert Downey Jr. was sort of coming to the end of his contract, and so they weren't sure if they were going to get him back or not.
Mm.
And so by having the ending that they did, it sort of allowed them to have an ending for Tony Stark just in case he never came back. But it was just open enough as well so that in the event they do get him back, which they clearly did, they could continue it on in some way.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, look, I looking back, I can sort of see why you would be a bit disappointed in that sense, knowing that the character does continue on. But look, you know, Marvel were in, a bit of a difficult position back then, so I don't blame them for making the choices that they did.
Hmm. I guess I always had one of those feelings where, you know, he was definitely a character that you had to continue. So I think that they would have made it work either way. I don't know. Like, I'm not disappointed with the ending of Iron Man 3. I think there was definitely a few things that couldn't have happened. I'm definitely a fan of them removing the fixed arc reactor to his chest and, you know, him having that surgery to kind of
get rid of the shrapnel.
You know, help him recover. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And, you know, it was a nice way to end the film. It wouldn't be the exact closing of the film that would be more of the more disappointments. I think if we fast forward to things like the final battle with Aldrich and all the extremist goons, I think that's where the film sort of started to go a bit, to have some of its disappointments, I guess.
Speaking of disappointments, what did you think of the Mandarin fakeout? Were you on board with the decision to do that? Or were you one of the fans that sort of wished they actually had a Mandarin, like a proper Mandarin in the film?
You know what's actually kind of funny about that? It actually took me a little bit longer than it should have for me to register that it was a bit of a fake out. You know, particularly, I think I'm definitely going to hand this off to Sir Ben Kingsley, you know, for his performance as Trevor, when he's kind of like, he's here, but he's not here. I thought it was actually kind of a genius kind of move. But at the same time, because the Mandarin is one of, or if not Tony's greatest nemesis in the comics, and you know, he's got this incredible backstory about him as well, which we haven't seen yet, but we have seen the Ten Rings throughout the MCU by this point in time. So I think it was definitely a disappointment to have the Mandarin kind of be this faked out character. Although it was portrayed really well in the film, I think the way that they did it couldn't have been more hilarious. But I think, you know, in terms of, you know, Aldrich Killian at the end just proclaiming that he was the Mandarin, I don't think that kind of worked. I think that's the part where it tends to go sour for myself and perhaps, you know, many other fans, because Aldrich Killian was developed to be, you know, someone who's a scientist, and he's, you know, he's developing extremis. It just sort of doesn't relate to the Mandarin that we all know. There is no magical powers that he has, and it just Aldrich's character build-up wasn't that great by that point either. He just had no legs to stand on as the Mandarin. It was kind of just a dramatic line for him to drop in the final battle.
Yeah, I think you're right in that Aldrich is certainly one of the weaker aspects of the film, and we'll get to him in a moment. But just taking it briefly back to the reveal of Trevor Slattery as the fake Mandarin. Yeah, I love the twist. I remember when I was watching it in the cinema, it shocked me as well. I was like, hang on, nah, he must be lying. You know, there's no way that he's not really the Mandarin. And I try to convince myself that, it's Sir Ben Kingsley. Why would you hire him to be some sort of comedic fool? But I love the way it turned out. And especially for me as a comic book reader, the fact that you can surprise me still with something like that is absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
And Trevor Slattery has just become one of my favorite characters in the MCU. He's like so good. Sir Ben Kingsley does a marvelous job.
And like to this day, I'm still cackling the same way I did when I watched it when the movie came out, because it was just it's genius. And then, you know, I don't know if I was probably expecting him to pull off like some sort of magical attack on Tony in the next minute, but like, yeah, he was completely just this character that was hired to act as the Mandarin. And I think it's also a shame because he had the look, you know, albeit he wasn't Asian, but he was what you'd expect from a terrorist kind of looking figure. You just wanted to see more and you just didn't get that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, his version of, you know, before the reveal that he wasn't actually the Mandarin, that iteration of the character or that sort of imagining of the Mandarin from the comic book, that was very intriguing. How it's sort of this mishmash of various cultures. So he's got like a Chinese-esque robe sort of thing. He's got dragon iconography around him. He's got that Captain America with the Anarchy A tattoo on the back of his neck. And he's got the beard, like a very Osama bin Laden-esque beard. And it is a shame, I guess, in that we didn't get that. But at the same time, you know, the reveal of Trevor as this sort of fake Mandarin thing doesn't mean that the actual Mandarin doesn't exist, you know? And as we know now, like with Shang-Chi, there is an actual Mandarin figure. But it's just so interesting seeing some of the fans just get worked up all about it. When I'm just like, there's nothing in the film contradicts the fact that there would be an actual Mandarin. Yeah. So it kind of shocked me that it got the reception that it did. But I mean, kudos to the filmmakers and Marvel for even allowing such an incredible twist to happen. Yeah, it's like, look, you and I, we've both seen, I think, the whole MCU up to this point, and this definitely has to rank up there as one of the biggest shocks and surprises, and the fact that they could even do that astounds me. So, yeah, kudos to them.
Definitely, and they were able to definitely rectify that with an extra scene, as I think that was featured on the Dark World Blu-ray, wasn't it?
The short film, All Hail the King.
Yeah, that one. So I think it was a good way to kind of rectify it, where, you know, you see Trevor again and the reveal that the Mandarin really is pissed. You know, as someone who hasn't seen Shang-Chi at this point in time, I really hope they kind of pay that back.
All right, let's move on to the actual, you know, in quotation marks here, Mandarin of the film, Aldrich Killian. Now, for those who haven't read the Extremis story, which, I mean, look, by the way, they didn't take, they took some elements from the comic book story. They didn't, I guess they didn't adapt the actual story itself. So Aldrich Killian in the comics, he has a very, very small part. He's like one of the guys who created Extremis or whatnot, and he kills himself in the first issue. But they expanded the character for the film and you know, pretty much gave him the big villain role. What did you think of his arc? I'm very interested to get your thoughts, Emmanuel.
I actually liked Guy Pearce's performance of Aldrich Killian. He definitely gave him a lot more character than what you get in the Extremis arc of the comics, which
was none.
which is none. which is a suicide letter and a mention. But I think, you know, if we start to go back to where we meet Aldrich Killian at the start, you know, he's this outright nerd-looking person, not someone who is memorable, which is funny because Aldrich in the comics isn't memorable at all. But, you know, it definitely shows how Tony was easily able to create one of his first demons in Eldritch Killian in itself. And I think that had the potential to be something better. I personally think now that, you know, he probably should have just remained as himself. And I think that would have sufficed better as a villain, as opposed to...
So having more as a... having been more of an intellectual villain as opposed to a physical threat, yeah, as well, you think?
Yeah, and like, to be honest, he probably didn't even need to proclaim that he was a Mandarin in the end.
You know, for me, yeah, look, Aldrich Killian, he was an interesting villain. I guess the thing I dislike is that they had him be this sort of stereotypical nerdy guy, and they really overdid it with the makeup on Guy Pearce. And look, I know what they were trying to do, and I just wish they didn't go so exaggerated and so full on with it, I think. But yeah, look, as villains go in the MCU, he's not the most memorable, even though his goal or what he was trying to do was quite interesting. I think it's a combination of the fact that they had to include the actual Trevor Slattery Mandarin, I guess. And so that kind of took away a lot of the spotlight on him, which I guess, look, is in keeping with the character. You know, he's the one creating this fake Mandarin and making him the figurehead. But yeah, it just means that you get a character or villain who doesn't quite stand out as much as he should.
I think I can certainly agree with that. Although the funny thing is, I actually like that, you know, that they kind of started him out as this like incredibly nerdy character, but you know that you can see that he's grown.
Oh yeah, don't get me wrong. I don't mind the fact that they had him start out as a nerdy character and you see him change, but I just think they just overdid it with the tropes. Like they gave him like this buck teeth and this long weird hair, yeah, and this limp, and like I know you want to see that clear change, and don't get me wrong, and that's, I suppose, an easy way of doing it, but I feel as though it's because it's so overdone, I don't know, it's so cliched to me, and I think they could have done it in a better way.
Hmm.
Emmanuel, you've read the Extremis story arc, haven't you?
Yeah, I have.
What did you think of that compared to what they did in the film? Yeah, like I said earlier, they only took elements of it, but the story in the comic itself is quite a good one, and it is one of the best Iron Man stories that exist. Would you have preferred that they actually adapted the story, you know, or more of the story from the comics as opposed to taking just certain elements?
To be honest, I think Marvel did what they needed to do. I think it was definitely a sort of a good payoff to the Extremis in the comics, you know, but I think, you know, I think it would have been difficult for them to fully, you know, integrate that storyline into what they were trying to achieve with Iron Man 3. I mean, there are some similarities with the Extremis where it does enhance recovery and strength and people were still going boom, but, you know, not a lot of people know that Tony, at some point during that story arc, he is injured to the point that he can no longer be Iron Man, and he's got to take a modified version of the Extremis serum to allow him to become Iron Man again. And I just feel like that plot point would not have worked for the film, because we already know he's injured, and the arc reactor is still currently keeping him alive. But yeah, I think for what they had, you know, the mention of Extremis definitely worked for the film in general, and it is more of an homage to the comic story arc, so I'm not really opposed to it. I think I would have liked a little bit more of the Extremis kind of armor that Tony does have in that comic arc, but again, it just would not have worked for what they were trying to achieve with Iron Man 3.
You know, one thing I wish they did sort of take on board a bit more from that arc is give Maya Hansen a bigger role. Because, spoilers for those who haven't read the comics, but she's revealed to be the actual villain of that arc, and she's wasted in this film.
Yeah, definitely.
Like I know that at one point she was meant to have a bigger role, and then it got cut down, and it's just, yeah, such a huge shame. Being that you are a huge Iron Man fan, are you aware of the Chinese version of Iron Man 3?
I was aware that there was Chinese release of the film, but I'm not really familiar with that. You know, if there were sort of any changes to the plot or any differences.
Yeah, okay. So when I say Chinese version of Iron Man 3, you know, I do mean that there is a slightly different version of the film. It's actually a little bit longer than what we got in here in the West. And The reason for that is Iron Man 3 was actually co-produced by a company called DMG Entertainment in China. And I believe that was done so that they could ensure the film would be released over in that country. Because China only allows a certain number of foreign films to be shown each year. And I guess by doing this, they kind of guaranteed a release. China is a very big market, so I can understand why Marvel or Disney would have done that. In any case, the film, like I said, was slightly longer. It didn't really impact the plot so much. What we had was more scenes with Dr. Wu. So when he meets Tony at the party in Switzerland, he sort of just has a bit more dialogue there. And then he shows up again in the middle of the film, and I do believe he sees a news or press conference sort of thing with Iron Man in China. And then at the end of the film, you see him talk with his assistant, who's played by Chinese actress Fan Bingbing, before the surgery. And, you know, she's worried about, we don't want to screw up this operation on one of the most important men in the world. And he reassures her and all that sort of thing. And look, it didn't amount to much. So we weren't missing out on anything by not seeing this particular version of the film. But it is a bit of an oddity, I must say.
Well, I think now that you've mentioned that, see, I think I would have liked to see that for myself.
Yeah, you can actually find some of the scenes, I think, on one of the bonus discs that Marvel have released. But it would have been good to see, I guess. But look, definitely not essential, right? If they didn't even introduce the character at the beginning and we just see Tony have that heart surgery, I don't think it would make any difference whatsoever.
Yeah,
he's a very inconsequential character for better or good, but. Yeah, it's just strange. Strange.
Strange.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Marvelous Synergy Podcast. Thank you so much again, Emmanuel, for joining me.
No worries. Definitely an honor. You know, all the best with the ongoing Marvelous Synergy. So definitely looking forward to what's next.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'll be sure to keep you updated. And for anyone else that does want to stay up to date as well, please like and follow the Marvelous Synergy Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr pages. We can also keep up to date with the latest MCU news. If you want to learn more about the MCU, please check out my guide to the films on Amazon. The books are filled with lots of information on how the films have been made. I list deleted scenes, Easter eggs, filming locations, and other bits of trivia. And on that note, I'll catch you next time.